Welcome back to the show, Pompey the Great and the Fall of the Roman Republic podcast, The Pirate Menace. I am Alan Keith.
And I am Lucas Murphy.
I think that went pretty well.
Yeah. Should we do the pirate? Let's try to do a pirate.
Well, like, we both have pirate accents.
Yeah, let's try it. You start out and then I'll chime in. Or should we just do the whole episode and like hardcore pirate like
and have no audience? You know, I don't think we should, because you know, I think we really try to go for historical authenticity here, and I have no idea what Cilician pirates sound like.
Yeah, I imagine they probably sounded very
like Johnny Depp.
Yeah, kind of like Johnny Depp. Maybe, you know, they probably all had eye patches, peg legs, hooks for hands, something like that. I don't know, something between that and like Somalian pirates without guns. Like, I imagine that's kind of the gist of it. But, I don't know. Gunpowder?
When was gunpowder invented?
I'm sure they had it, I know they had it in ancient China, like ancient, yeah. Ancient Asia, I should say, not ancient China, but ancient Asia, and I think it was coming over here, like, I want to say as early as the 800s, but I don't think it was really, like, a serious battlefield tool until the fall of Constantinople, when cannons brought down the wall. I believe that was in the, I can't remember off the top of my head. I think that was in the 14th century?
I heard they invented gunpowder for fireworks, like celebrations. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure.
It was probably on that night that somebody was like, I got an idea! You can put that in a cannon.
Yeah, if you took me back in time and told me, hey, we need to invent gunpowder, I would have no idea where to start. Like, I would have absolutely no idea. Like, that shows you how modern of a human I am. Like, I couldn't recreate gunpowder. I couldn't recreate, probably, I don't know how to refine ore. Like, I guess you just heat it up and pour it. I mean, heat up rocks with ore in it. I don't know.
Well, the Romans couldn't get, I actually have a pretty good background in metallurgy, but the Romans couldn't get furnaces, like, hot enough to melt steel. Mm-hmm. So they could pour bronze, but they couldn't pour steel. So they had like blacksmith all their steel or whatever, you know, like forge steel implements.
Interesting. I know that they had they actually on a lot of their pylons during the Marian reforms, they actually switched to like a wooden rivet instead of a metal rivet because they wanted the pylon to break so it couldn't be thrown back at them. Which I think is erroneously, a lot of that is erroneously, like, credited to Caesar. But, you know, whatever.
He gets all the credit. C-sections. People think that had something to do with Julius Caesar. Oh my gosh. People gotta stop using Disney for their historical, you know, background.
Okay, so the fall of Constantinople was in 1200. My mistake. I just wanted to correct that so I don't sound like a complete boob.
Well, I said in the Spanish podcast, the Spanish episode, that Lucian was a 4th century poet. Hmm. I forget when Lucian lived, but it wasn't in the 4th century.
Yeah. I mean, I wish I could be someone with an encyclopedic mind that could recall any, detail in history. Without having to have, like, notes, but I'm just not that gifted, I guess.
Oh, how are you, Luke?
I'm doing okay. How are you doing?
I'm tired.
I heard there's some scuttle with a beast of the field over at your place.
Yeah, I was up all night trying to hunt a possum, and I told you this before the first podcast we were recording got cut out, and I was up all night outside in the yard with a slingshot trying to kill a possum that had killed my ducks because I can't use a firearm in the city, and this in no way relates to Pompey the Great except that it occurred to me that a slingshot will probably want to get the job done. This was a big possum, a really big possum, so I grabbed my Gladius out of the library and ran outside with it, and I guess I would bludgeon the creature to death, but the Gladius was made of wood. I made it in 8th grade in shop, so it would have probably been pretty brutal.
Did you,
But I have coffee in front of me. I have 2 cups of coffee.
Well, did you gather your neighbors and form a sentry block?
No, but my next door neighbor, had a possum in a trap I noticed this morning, so I think that's really what I need to do, is get a trap for the possum.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Okay. Yeah.
So, Rome had completely destroyed any naval threat in the Mediterranean, at least by the end of the Second Punic War, so why are we even talking about pirates?
Well, it all goes back to, let's bring it back to the Punic Wars. I know we seem to go back to the Punic Wars quite a bit, but they were a major groundbreaking war that had far-reaching consequences even to our present day. However, Carthage was, if you can recall, was a major maritime empire. Like, they primarily were a maritime trading empire with vast control over the entire Mediterranean. So what they did is they had a sort of leasing ability, so not free trade, but at least to allow their ships to get to where they need to get, kept down a menace of piracy among the Mediterranean. But when Rome destroyed Carthage, we got to remember Rome really wasn't a maritime didn't have a strong maritime tradition, and so when Rome took over the world scene, defeated Carthage, they really did not enforce any kind of maritime protections. And this compounded, from Gibraltar to the Levant. There were pirates that sort of started forming connections and networks, safe harbors for the pirates to hide out. And it almost became a routine pirating situation, to the point where there was there's immense harm done to Rome's access to trading goods, a lot of the corn supply was extremely damaged during that time, and this had reached such a fever pitch even during Marius's time that there were talks of having to do something about the pirate menace. So we had, I believe during Marius's empire, was, assigned the task of going after the pirates. He just went to the east of the Adriatic and did a few, minor sorties. There wasn't a whole lot done there. But it was always looked at as kind of a stepping stone to get to the real prize, which were the rich provinces in the east, where Mithridates was, and to be able to get it really wasn't viewed as a super critical problem until 70 or so BC.
In the previous year, the ex praetor M. Antonius, who was the son of the M. Antonius, who was sent against the pirates in 102 BC, also spectacularly failed in that expedition. So we have 2 Antoniuses sent in the field against it. And in 78, their Servilius Vatia was sent with an army to the pirate stronghold in Cilicia. And apparently, I guess he may have had a land force, and he basically conquered one of the strongholds of the pirates, but he actually made the situation worse by giving them no place to retreat to, no place to call home, and that really just forced more of them into the seas in the end. And in March of 70 BC, it seems that the Senate had voted Crete to be allocated as one of the consular provinces of that year.
Right, and also, we have to remember what was going on in the East with Sulla. You know, Sulla was raping the East. He was going into all the wealth out of the area, imposing extreme indemnities on everyone, and he was essentially plundering as much as anyone could plunder. In his general Lucullus, who eventually took over the campaign against Mithridates, was much more lenient. Everyone celebrated him being in the East, prosecuting the war against Mithridates. And we're even told that at Mithridates is not a fair, even though he was accepted, in 74 as well as in 88, when Mithridates murders all of the Roman men, women, and children throughout the eastern provinces, the East willingly complies, but what they got was a despot that was equally as bad, if not worse than the Romans.
So did you want to talk about some of the problems Rome was facing with this pirate menace?
Yeah. I mean, Rome was experiencing crippling grain shortages. They're experiencing some extreme civil unrest due to the intense raising of the cost of corn. A lot of people are hungry. That's usually when social problems tend to manifest themselves into political action, because when people are hungry, they don't really stay hungry for very long. But people are desperate, they're more likely to engage in violence. That's kind of one of the big problems with the pirate menace. Of course, there's also talk of the pirates kind of being in cahoots with Mithridates. There's probably a lot of anti-Roman resentment throughout Greece and Asia Minor, which is, modern day Turkey, Syria. And they progressively started raiding Italy itself. Supposedly these, Romans, even captured two praetors, Sextilius and Bellinius, and the daughter of the elderly Antonius, which we had already talked about before. Other distinguished captives were, obviously Caesar and Clodius. Caesar had you kind of see his character come out when he's, we find Caesar joking around with some of the pirates, and then he kind of says, well, when I escape here, I'm going to come back and crucify all or kill all of you. And then he does. Clodius, I believe, meets a much more uncomfortable fate with the pirates, as I believe he's sodomized quite a bit by the pirates, which is pretty horrific.
Allegedly. But,
I don't know. With Clodius's temperament, I'm not sure how he would have taken to that. Who knows? But there's all sorts of rumors about people being sodomized. I mean, supposedly Caesar was sodomized by the king of Bithynia. There's all sorts of rumors of sodomy going around in the ancient world, apparently. So by 67, really the matter was really urgent, because they had disrupted this corn supply. I mean, there were captives being taken. They were raiding, Italian cities. People, whether it's true or not, they believed that, the pirates were in cahoots with Mithridates, and supposedly there was some sort of also religious connection with the cult of Mithras that was really big, in the East, and Mithridates was sort of looked at as almost a, living come to revenge, Asia Minor and, Greece, who's come to revenge them, and pour their vengeance out on Rome. So there was, pseudo-religious overtones. There were, thoughts that there was a vast conspiracy. Whether that's true or whether that's a witch hunt type situation that we're just hearing about through the pages of history, we're not sure. Or at least I'm not sure. A more studied historian would probably be able to answer that question more effectively. But anyway.
So after 67 BC, I think you mentioned a pirate ship had sailed up the Tiber and even threatened the port of Ostia and defeated a consular army.
Mm-hmm.
So I think war was at this point absolutely imminent. And unfortunately for Pompey, who we have every reason to expect.
And Ostia was the major.
Oh yeah, you want to talk about what Ostia was?
Ostia was the major grain port of Rome. It's really, Rome is inset a little bit, on off the coast of Italy. Ostia was a major grain port of Rome. It would have been getting grain from Sicily. It would have been getting grain from Africa. It would have been getting, pretty much all the grain that's needed, in Rome. That's all I wanted to say about Ostia.
Now, we have the sources tell us that after the consulship of Pompey and Crassus, both had decided not to take up a governorship. And I think the reasons why are a little hazy. It seems to me that it was probably unthinkable for a man like Pompey to take up traditional and ordinary duties. You know, going from master of the Spanish peninsula to governor was probably seemed to be a step backwards, for him. And, I also wanted to point out that the, making, the Mediterranean, the, I mentioned that in 70 BC, the Senate had voted Crete to be allocated to one of the consular provinces of that year. And based on a law of, Gaius Gracchus in 123, he had a legislation passed that barred consuls that year that are elected the year that a province is allotted to govern that province. So, the consuls of 67, would be the first consuls eligible for, the provinces allotted in 70, which would legally bar Pompey from being allotted the province of Crete, if that makes any sense. So he was kind of technically out of the running to, initially take up the threat, if I'm making any sense there. And on the subject of Pompey not taking any command, I thought you mentioned the other day that you wanted to talk about that. I read last night, in fact, in Valius that Pompey had took an oath going in to his consulship that he would not take a province, which I'm guessing is probably BS. But it did turn out that in January 1st of 69, Pompey and Crassus did retire as private citizens. And I'm guessing this is because Pompey had his eye on an extraordinary or unusual command. There really wasn't one available. and technically, since the province of Crete was voted to be a consular province in 70, he was technically barred from going there in 69. I don't know if you can weigh in on that at all, or... And I don't mean to say that Pompey was absolutely idle during his time after his consulship. This would have been the first time in 8 years that he had any kind of chance to lead somewhat of an ordinary life. But Plutarch tells us, in kind of a hyperbole in his text on Pompey, that a lot of great men of unusual careers or of preeminence or military glory, they face a lot of scorn and develop a bad reputation when they go into private life. But we have no reason to think that Pompey was absolutely idle. He was clearly planning some of his next move and definitely cultivating his clients and extending his patronage.
Right. And I think if we look at the elections around these years, we have to see, you know, the weakness, really the weaknesses of Pompey's position that he's in, you know, especially in urban politics, and the struggle, we also see the struggle of the Optimates, you know, trying to retain control. You know, in 69, you see, Hortensius and, Q. Metellus as consuls with M. Metellus as praetor. For the consulship, Pompeius had been able to produce no challenger, although his adherent, Pelicanus, the tribute of 71, succeeded, in securing the praetorship. A third Metellus, Lucius, the praetor of 71, followed his brother Quintius in 68, but death actually came to weaken the power of the Metelli. Lucius, and we know Pompey is pretty deeply connected with the Metelli. Lucius died early in his year of office, and Marcus, the praetor of the previous year, never reached the... the other consul of 68, Marcius Rex, was reliable, and so was one at least of the consuls of 67. M. Glabrio was also another individual, that he was also the other consul, I believe. There might have been some doubts as he presided without bias at the trial of Verres in 70, as we had talked about previously during Pompey's consulship. There was a lot of bribery at this time, Calpurnius Piso really only achieved power through making these horrendous briberies. First he bribed the voters, and then he even bribed his potential accusers. So he's basically just dealing out the dough to everybody. The events in 70, were basically to engage the, attention of the tribute of 67, C. Cornelius, face of Optima opposition to put a stop to the bribery and other forms of corruption. Cornelius had served as a quaestor under Pompeius in the Spanish War. Pompeius may well have had an interest in his major's Piso's opposition to the bribery law, although popular pressure forced him to introduce a watered down version himself. As we've seen time and time again, one person will suggest a law, and then the opposition will have to support that law just because it's the popular thing to do, even though they have no intention of ever completing that law. You know, we saw that with the Gracchi, and the Optimates' opposition to the Gracchi, or the Senate's opposition to the Gracchi. This confirms to us that the Optimates were resorting to bribery to basically keep out any candidates associated with Pompey. You know, there's a concerted effort of bribery to produce any competition from Pompey, and potentially try to support as a political figure. So he's definitely being blackballed from the political scene in Rome at this time. which couldn't have sat well. You know, I don't think it was just that he, you know, took an oath to be, you know, a charming, you know, polite Roman. He was being obviously blackballed. The Metelli were losing power, even though Metellus Pili, still the most powerful individual in Rome. You know, the family was, you know, really probably all the families were starting to fall. You know, by the end of the Roman Republic, you know, all the families sort of meld into one. You know, and you have, you know, these people, you know, with these exceedingly long names because they're multiple family names into one, you know, into one long string. That was kind of the conditions of going into 70.
That kind of brings me back to Marius, if our listeners remember Marius. And he showed us the value that the tribunes had in furthering the aim of the populous party. And Pompey clearly had that in mind in 70 when he restored the tribunes. And Pompey seems to have been more aware than his contemporaries of the value of a just and sensible provincial administration for the peace and solidarity of the empire. And we see a little bit of Pompey's character here, because corrupt administration like that of Gaius Verres, which you mentioned, was all but common practice. And even more, the efficiency and moderation Pompey desired to see what wasn't always easy to achieve in Rome, given the year-long commands and the way in which the governors were selected.
Right, and also another throwback to kind of Marius is, you know, in 67, Gabinius started. A Gabinius, he was a friendly tribune of Pompey's, started launching an attack against Lucullus, who was Sulla's right-hand man. And during the War of Mithridates, he had taken over the campaign in Asia Minor against Mithridates. And they started criticizing him, and even his own troops were supposedly criticizing him, supposedly. And the Equites started bringing the same charges that they brought against Q. Metellus, who was the general persecuting the Jugurthine War that eventually Marius took. You know, and they started complaining that he was deliberately prolonging the war to retain his command and enhance his glory. It was the exact same charges that were leveled against Metellus in Africa that are now being leveled against Lucullus. The Equestrians' discontent with Lucullus was more than likely launched by the Equites, not because he was enhancing his personal glory, but because we're told he was very lenient with the East, probably because he realized that the more he impoverished the communities in the East, the greater the pirate problem. You know, Rome never was really able to deal with partisan military tactics. They were never really able to deal, you know, Rome, if they had another opposing army, they could march out and butcher them wholesale. Rome could not deal with small groups of people coming, doing raids in the middle of the night, you know, which is what we're starting to see with the pirate, you know, the pirate problem. So that's kind of what I mean by partisan military tactics.
And I want to add that I think Pompey, saw that there was a problem with the way the government or the empire was being administered. Men who were elected consul could borrow money against what they were expected to extort in their consular province that they would go to the next year. And I think Pompey wanted to take the decision to allocate these commands out of the place of the optimates and into the hands of the people, and he wanted a better way to, I think that genuinely he wanted a better way to administer some of these issues, even if it meant the use of extraordinary commands by extraordinary people, you know, such as himself. And it's very interesting that the machinery to do this was provided by Tiberius Gracchus in 133 BC. And I think things really change in 68.
Really, I disagree. I don't think that Pompey was really looking to place the spoils of war, if you will, in the hands of the people. I think he was more, you know, I think Pompey was a soldier, and he really wanted to garner favor with the soldiers, like what we saw what he did with the Spanish veterans. who ended up with land, grants of land. They're enjoying civil life. I really think, you know, a lot of Lucullus's troops are probably looking at, you know, these veterans who had successfully completed their task, and now they were living, you know, wealthily. You know, but I think it was a different, you know, it's a much different area. You know, the East is a much different area, and, you know, really, it's a much different situation, and they were exploiting it. I mean, Saul was exploiting it in one of the most probably horrific, ways. I mean, massive amounts of debt, slavery. You know, if you didn't pay your debts, you either had to be sold in you had to sell your family into slavery, or you were put to the rack. You know, I mean, so there's probably some fairly horrific, situations. You know, we have, and this is during the early invasions, but if you look at the two Batos and, the Illyria, you know, one of the Batos says something like, you know, you told us that you'd give us law and order, but you've really just unleashed wolves upon, you know, the Roman wolves upon our people and our cities. You know, and there's a massive insurrection, you know, in the Illyria, which was in the east. But obviously, you know, the Romans were highly predatory in their lending practices, in their, military campaigns. They were extremely predatory. I mean, no doubt about it. And predatory to the point where it was viewed as a strength to be predatory.
So I think things, took another good, things changed, took another turn in 68 when the news of L. Lucullus, who I'm assuming is one of your illustrious ancestors, Luke.
Lucullus?
Lucullus.
Yeah.
Anyway, never mind. He was governor of Cilicia and Bithynia in the Mithridatic War. He had won spectacular victories and success. News of his success had reached Rome. And Lucullus is going to be dealt a really bad hand by fate, but he did have spectacular success at times against Mithridates. Lucullus was certainly a member
perhaps,
of the... Go on.
Oh, he was perhaps... Lucullus was, as we said, Saul's right-hand man. But he was perhaps one of the most insightful generals that we can see, that we see fighting in the East. You know, he really learns a lot of the lessons, that I think Sulla, probably would have learned, and that I think we later see, you know, at the end of the pirate campaign, Pompey has, to where you can't, grind people, so hard and expect them to sit there and take it. You know, eventually people are going to start, even if they've given you everything, if you keep continuing to press them, they will fight because they get desperate. You know, that's exactly what was going on in the East. You know, not to get off topic or political, but you could even say that's what's going on in right now, with, you know, people who've been engaged in wars for the last 20 to 30 years, you know, eventually resistance starts forming just as a reaction to living in a society that's constantly under war and pressure, you know, and whether that is.
And I also think that, a lot of his success also resulted in a lot of jealousy in the Optimate and the, Pompeian factions, especially the latter. And I think that led to an aggressive campaign to undermine Lucullus. I think you mentioned Claudius being sent there, possibly by Pompey, into Lucullus's camp, to tamper with the troops' loyalty. Plutarch says that he was talking about how happy the Spanish veterans were while Lucullus's men were being marched further and further. This was when P. Claudius Pulcher was wintering with his men out east. And the Populars Tribune in 74, what was his name?
Quintius?
Yeah, he was Tribune. And he, and I thought, and even back in 74, he clashed with the then consul Lucullus, accusing him of greed and excessive ambition. And he was instrumental in securing the removal of his Cilician command and the discharge of some of his, troops.
Right. And Cilicia was actually assigned to, Marcus Rex. And Lucullus actually, as he, on his way, to Cilicia, he, Marcus Rex received a plea for help to by from Lucullus to put down a mutiny at Nisibis, I guess. I'm not sure how to pronounce that in its original pronunciation, but Nisibis. So we also have sort of Pompey was plotting behind the scenes, seeing that how he couldn't go about procuring a command of the lucrative Mithridates War, through internal political means because he was being blackballed. There's perhaps, some hint that Pompey was inciting some of these mutinies, perhaps inspired Quinticus and Gabinius's attacks on Lucullus. Perhaps he was in cahoots with Gabinius, who introduced the law that assigned Bithynia and Pontus, to M. Glabrio in 67.
I think it's definitely possible. I mean, the only two opportunities Pompey would have had at this time to even partially measure up to his spectacular Spanish campaigns would have been a campaign against the pirates, or of course, the lucrative, campaigns against Mithridates. And he had every motive to be behind it and have Gabinius in his pocket. Gabinius served with him in Spain. But, Plutarch says that there was no connection, that Gabinius was just a wretched base man or something like that.
Mm-hmm. I definitely think Gabinius was acting, when he introduced this law, the Tribune Gabinius, he was definitely acting on behalf of Pompey, with no doubt about it, because we see him later start to sort of suggest that Pompey should come in and take control. He starts extolling Pompey's abilities and begging him not to be deterred from his duties, and Pompey is kind of, Pompey's kind of playing like he doesn't want to do this, and that the Roman people are forcing him to go and do this, accept the Imperium from the people, when it was really, Pompey's machinations all along.
And in July of 68, when Gabinius was elected tribune, plans had to have been underway to place Pompey in command of the pirate situation, because by the end of 68, the organization required for such a massive undertaking, must have been partially completed, given how quickly we'll see Pompey act.
Yeah, and see extreme opposition from the Senate. Except for Caesar, who was actually eager to win popular support. But we see, in this law to give Imperium to deal with the pirates, this pirate menace, which is actually, I think we talked about it before, it's actually more of a stepping stone, to get to the war in the East, because that's where they were, supposedly these pirates had a stronghold in Cilicia. But we see the consul Piso actually warning Pompeius that if he tried to set himself up in defiance as sort of a king or as a new Romulus, the fate of Romulus might be in store for him, which obviously we know from early Roman history that Romulus, one, either ascended into the clouds and became a god, or he was murdered and his corpse was never found. He was murdered by the Senate and his corpse was never found. So those are the two.
I thought he was struck by lightning.
Yeah, that's another one. That's another way he might have died. I think out of the three, either being struck by lightning, you know, ascending into the heavens on a cloud, or being, you know, knifed to death and then buried in a shallow grave, I'm probably going to say the third is probably the most accurate. And, you know, that sort of a history of a tradition of opposing kings and opposing tyrants, or at least the Roman Republic had. Anyone that tried to establish themselves as a king was sort of threatened with murder. So we also have, in addition to this law from Hortensius, you know, the famed orator of Rome, he spoke at length and repeated his arguments before the people. He put it this way. He said, if such power was to be a single man, then Pompeius more than any other was worthy of it. But in the interest of security, no such grant should be made. The Senate became furious with Gabinius for proposing this law, and they also attempted to lynch him, or apparently told they were attempting to lynch Gabinius in reply. The Roman mob, the Roman people, attacked the Senate and seized Piso, and had Gabinius not intervened to pacify the crowd, the consul would have been killed. So, you know, this is not just a matter of trifling Roman politics. I mean, the people and the Senate were coming to the point where they were, you know, the Senate was trying to kill a tribune, and the unwashed masses, if you will, of Rome were trying to literally murder a consul, which is pretty insane.
So not only was Pompey repeating the methods of the Gracchi, but the Senate was responding in the way their ancestors did. And this all happening in the early January of 67. And we see the populist faction repeating the mechanisms implemented by the Gracchi, and violence is again happening in the political arena. That, I'm thinking, is all the time we have for this episode.
Yes.
Episode one, I guess, of The Pirate Menace, and we will conclude.
Next episode, we will see how the Gabinius is proposed, and how Pompey persecutes the pirates in the East.
All right, so thank you for listening to Pompey the Great and the Fall of the Roman Republic. You can like us on Facebook. I think we have an email for questions or concerns, which...
lifeofpompey@gmail.com.
Yeah, so feel free to send us questions. Thank you for listening.
Thanks.
Also.
Test. Sulpicius.
Testing.
Sulpicius.
Sulpicius.
Antoninus.
Sulpicius.
Antoninus.
That's not a real name.
I beg to differ.
Antoninus.
That was the poet in the movie version of Spartacus.
Oh. All right, I'm going to give a countdown at 5.
4.
4.
3.
3.
2.
2.
1.
1. Jesus Christ. 5.
4.
3.
2.
1. Why is this?
Because we have a delay.
Why?
There's a delay here.
But. Oh, okay. Alright, you okay. Count that. I'll try to stay with
one,
you, okay?
Wait. 5.
4.
4.
3.
3. 2.
2.
1.